Welcome to the Time and Motion podcast with me, your host, Lee Stevens. For over 25 years, I've worked with businesses all over the world to improve the technology and the people within them. In this podcast, I share some of my experiences and I chat to guests who generously share their stories of how to, or in some cases, how not to, live a productive life. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, and welcome to episode 6 of the Time and Motion podcast. This episode is the second of two parts where I catch up with speaking coach Michael Philpott. Michael coaches lots of famous politicians, business executives, and other prominent people across New Zealand how to speak better. One of the speakers he coached actually did one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time. Michael had some amazing stories to tell, and I didn't think I'd be doing him justice cramming it all into an hour slot. So if you haven't done so already, you may find it useful to listen to part one first. Michael talks about overcoming adversity despite having such a tough life. He was sent to an orphanage at the age of 5. He was diagnosed later in life with ADHD, and he also battled addiction to Class A drugs. In this episode, part two, Michael also talks about his career here in New Zealand. He talks about his involvement in TED Talks and some of the people he's coached as a speaking coach. He also tells you how you can become a better speaker in all walks of life and some of the common mistakes we all make when speaking. So I hope you enjoy part two of Michael's story, which is episode 6 of the Time and Motion podcast. On with the show. We've talked about your success professionally at that time. Obviously, for the outside world, you're living your best life and doing all that fantastic stuff. But I read in a post about a month ago, 2 months ago, that you was actually having quite a lot of upheaval in your personal life at that time. And was addicted to Class A drugs. So what's going on there?
That was a nice soft lead in. When you're at your best, right? So this is one of the things I learned about my very much younger self. Somewhere along the way, there was a self-fulfilling prophecy created that you would be a failure. And maybe it's the ADHD, maybe it was a bunch of other stuff, but that combination led to me being at my absolute best and then somehow sabotaging it, right? So I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, I was doing outdoor education, I was running 7 days a week, like running 7 days a week. I would run to my course. I would run home. Well, actually, I didn't run home. I ran straight from my training to my martial arts, which was Wing Chun. I used to do Wing Chun on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and I did stick and knife fighting on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then on Saturdays and Sundays, I would run with a backpack on all day. That was my routine, as well as during the day I was doing my outdoor education training. So I'm this like peak of fitness and health.
And are you doing that because you've got so much nervous energy? Is that you mentioned about that shiny need to do something else? Is it so? Was that your way of coping of all this nervous energy we've got? And look, I can resonate to a certain extent, probably not at the levels of someone like yourself, but you've always got something. You've always got to be doing something. You've got to have your mind stimulated. You've got to get that kick, right? So at the time, you're doing it in a good way. You're doing exercise and you're outdoors and you're probably doing all the things that these 300-page self-help books will tell you to do, right?
Pretty much.
So you're doing all that. Yep. So you're doing all the good stuff.
Yep.
So what went wrong?
Technically, you're right. I could have run a marathon, right? And been like, I could have followed that pathway and then ended up famous for doing all of those things. What I was driven by, ironically, was people used to say to me, how can you do what you do? And I found it unusual because my question was, how can you not do what I do? You can do what I can do. And that drove me to be able to do things that other people couldn't do, which is a really strange thing because the change happened when I'm at the peak of my life. And then I'd separated myself so much from my youth, from my upbringing, growing up in Whanganui, it was very bad. who I associated with, the things that I did were really bad. And then I've totally grown out of that. And then one of my friends introduces me to his half brother, and his half brother is everything that I used to be. And it just triggers me and I'm gone. Like, I'm taken back to my childhood self. And it was a challenge, essentially. So
what did you used to be?
A very angry, hostile, unable to communicate deeper thoughts, feelings, and emotions, and used to settle more for rage, type of person, right? So very angry, and always in trouble. So, like, always in trouble with the police, you know, getting arrested a lot. I got arrested for rioting. I got arrested for a lot of stuff back then. You know, at least once a year I'd get arrested for something. I actually got kicked out of the North Island for a year. I wasn't allowed. The police told me I wasn't allowed to live in the North Island for a year.
Why was that?
That was because of the rioting. So that, you know, they gave me a choice. They said, you know, you can either go to, you know, Borstal or, you know, Gladiator School for young people, which is where you basically learn to become more of a criminal, or you can go to the South Island.
What was you writing for?
It was for, one of your friends tells you a story about being, you know, something unjust happening to them, and you have a group of your people and you decide to go and see these other people who have done this terrible thing to your friend, and it gets out of hand, and then you end up with a paddy wagon and riot police finding you down the street and arresting all of you and putting you all in the docks. So really bad, right? Like, really bad stuff happening. And a lot of stuff around me was, I was drug dealing as well for gangs at the time, just really low-level stuff, but, you know, run into violence with guns, you know, presented to me over money that was owed to people, to me by people, but I ended up with the guns in my face. It's just that type of stuff.
So you'd escaped all of that.
I'd escaped all of that, right?
You're running marathon. I saw you got your six pack going on there.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Quite envious there. I was eating a breakfast burrito. It's like the juxtaposition of that moment.
Yeah,
I was like, oh yeah. But you'd escaped that life, living the best life, and so you met this guy, brother of a friend.
Yeah.
What was he offering you that you didn't have?
So you mentioned before about, you know, you could have run marathons, you could have done these things. So if there was one thing I knew and understand now looking back on it, is I could have kept running for the entirety of my life, and I would have always ended up at the same point that I'm at now, which was, there is something that is driving you to do what you do all the time. And it's not a healthy driver. You know, the fact that you have to run every day, the fact that you have to exhaust yourself just so you can sleep, there is something gnawing away at you deep down under there that needs to come to the surface. And what happened was, I always knew that in the background, right? Unconsciously, it was there. I grew up always thinking, what is wrong with me? Like, I am so different to everyone else. There is something wrong with me. And the more I became around other normality, it just stood out more that there was something really different about me, or I thought there was something really different about me. What that person offered me was a mirror of what was still inside. It had never gone away. I just covered it up with exhaustion. And they introduced me to heroin, right? So they were like, I think they were staying at my place for a couple of days, and it was him and his partner, and they were just like, oh, you know, we're taking heroin. And I'm like, I've heard that if you have that once, you're addicted. And they're like, yeah, supposedly. And I'm like, ha, it never happened to me, because I'm super fit, super strong. And he's like, do you want some? And I was like, sure. It won't do anything. So sure enough, they gave me some, and it didn't do anything. So they got some more, and then it did something. And for the first time in my life, and This is not an endorsement for drug addiction.
No, not at all.
But for the first time in my life, I felt something which I'd never felt before, which was a sense of relaxed. My brain relaxed, my body relaxed. Now knowing about ADHD, you can understand. It was like there was something that turned everything off. And I'd never experienced that before. Not alcohol, nothing. Bearing in mind, I wasn't drinking. I hadn't drunk for months. And drinking was never my gig anyway. A sense of calm and relax washed over me. And sure enough, I wanted that again and again and again and again. And 10 years later, I found out that I might have maybe become addicted to it.
And what sort of time frame are we talking about here then, Michael?
So remember how you said you looked at those photos and you were like, yeah, the six-pack ab and stuff? Yeah.
So what, 15 years ago, 20 years ago?
Where are we now? Yeah, around 15, if not. Yeah, 15, be 15. But what's interesting, right, is all the photos where you look through and it's this healthy person, that whole time was addiction. Now, where it gets really interesting with addiction, right, is I was using for 10 years, I was using one of the strongest painkillers that you can get to basically cover pain. But I needed it at a super high level to cover the pain that was deep down inside. But the thing with that drug, that particular drug, is it's very similar to alcohol. It's a suppressant. So think of a building. When you take it, you turn off all the lights in the building. And there is that sense of calm, but there's no creativity, there's no growth, there's no nothing. So for 10 years, I'm just getting by on my skills that I've gathered over time, but there's no growth. But I'm doing it to be like everyone else around me. That's how I saw it, to be sedated, essentially. And then I ended up, somewhere else with a different drug, because people say, how did you get off heroin? And it's like, well, I actually attempted a whole bunch of stuff. I was taking, you know, medication that you had to take manually yourself that would stop you from feeling the effects of it, but it was by choice. So I ended up flying to Perth and meeting a guy called Dr. George O'Neill, who put these pills, they implant into the subcutaneous layer of fat and down in the belly area, and they would release over 9 months, so you couldn't touch, you know, you couldn't use drugs at all. You could if you wanted, but it didn't do anything. So I tried all of these different things, but what eventually stopped me was by finding a drug that was better. So I took a drug that turned on all the lights in the building, and my whole life changed. So I went from being sedated to being awake and alive. I don't know if you've ever seen a movie called Awakenings. Check it out, everyone. So it's Robin Williams, and it's through an area where they start these people are all in, like, basically comatosed, but deeper than that. And they bring them awake by using a chemical called L-DOPA. And I did all this research on it, and it's an amphetamine, right? So here's me after 10 years of being sedated and just sort of like not dealing with my emotions and what trauma was lying underneath. I start taking this chemical that just turned the lights on, and I wanted to know the answer to everything. So you asked me the question before, you know, how did you end up in an orphanage? I wanted to know that too. You know, up until then, I just let it all go. But then I started asking questions and wanted to know some answers. So irony of that whole cycle is that I get off all of those things. I stop doing all of that stuff. And then I walk into my doctor's office after my wife going, something's wrong with you. You need, you know, like our relationship is straining. I walk into my doctor's office and I joke and I say, I think I need to be legally microdosed. So what have they put me on? The drugs that I knew were the ones that were right for me in the first place.
Wow.
Microdosed. So essentially, I was finding out that I had ADHD plus a lot of other stuff going on underneath the surface, and my body always knew what I wanted. And that was what resolved the whole drug addiction thing. Yeah.
So heroin's obviously quite a powerful drug, and probably like a lot of people, I would base a lot of what I would assume to be happening with that drug based on train spotting. So
yeah.
The scene where they go into the toilet I think that's what put Ewan McGregor on the map, right?
Yep.
And I think, you know, that probably did more for heroin, I think, you know, in terms of just what life's really like, you know, and Tommy Lee Miller and all those famous actors. Mm. So how did you eventually get off of heroin?
Like I said, I got addicted to methamphetamine.
So you transferred it from one thing to the other?
Transferred it, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But the difference, here's the thing, right? So you've got, like I said, one drug turned off the lights in the building and turned off emotional response. The other drug put all the lights on. But another movie reference, Limitless. Yeah. Imagine Limitless, that was me. Yeah. My brain needed a hard kick to get back into gear. And it took it, but it was unsustainable. That was one of the key things with that drug, was it's super unsustainable. And gradually, I, with all the lights on, I started to educate myself about a whole bunch of different things. And eventually I just stopped. It was just one day, it was like, I'm done. I don't need that anymore.
Yeah. Yep. Excuse my naivety on this subject, but how big a problem do you think sort of Class A drugs are in New Zealand?
Oh, huge, huge, huge. So, you know, the methamphetamine in New Zealand is really bad right now and has been getting, you know, gradually worse. And the thing being, right, is if we've got all these people out there who are undiagnosed with ADHD and autism and all across the spectrum, you've got all of these things going on, plus trauma. People are just self-medicating. We've got a country, we've got a planet full of people who are self-medicating. And the reason being is because the health system is too hard. I remember going to a doctor when I needed some help around the heroin thing. I went to the, you know, professionals and I said, look, I need help with this. And they said, we can't help you because of whatever it was. It was the drug that stopped me from feeling the effects of heroin. I was on a thing called Rivia, which is, you know, originally it was made for alcoholism and it gave alcoholics hangovers. Yeah. But it just so happened that it also coated the brain receptors so that you couldn't feel the effects of heroin. But that was a byproduct. But when I was buying it, because it wasn't for alcoholism, you know, from the pharmacy, I was getting it from the pharmacy and it had to come through a doctor's referral. It was costing me heaps, and so I went to the people to talk to them about it, and they were like, here's the thing, we can't do it for that, and if we gave it to you, you'd be self-administering this thing. And I'm like, it's a pill that stops me from using heroin. I said, so what happens when I leave here today and you can't help me? And I'm like, well, we can set up an appointment for you in 3 weeks to come back. I'm like, I'm a heroin addict in your office right now. Where do you think I'm going to be in 3 weeks? And it was just this look on their face of like, that's all we can offer. And I'm like, see ya. So I'd been doing, you know, I'm what they would call a high functioning, that's what I was, addiction, which means that you can do things, but you definitely see both sides of the lifestyle. Coming back to your question, how bad is it in New Zealand? Way beyond what anyone can ever imagine, right? So I've met so many people back then that – they just function. They're doing their jobs. And they, you know, they meet that drug. It fulfills a lot of needs for them in a social way, in a taking care of whatever is missing in their brain or in their life kind of way. And it fixes that, but then it's illegal and it's expensive. And now they're addicted to it. And now they're down the rabbit hole that they can't come back from.
Yeah, and a lot of the time it's the mask, it's the way that you deal with the crap that you've got going in your life at that point in time. And for years in the UK, it was actually, still is, alcohol. You know, and you think about some of the trauma and the horrible things that some of these guys and girls have gone through. And like you say, unfortunately, there isn't a pill that you can take that will cure it all, but there's, yeah, that way you say like the answer to the problem is not at the bottom of a glass, but you try telling that to people to actually go, well, no, if that cures that pain for whatever, you know. And there's people, you know, you hear some of these stories of horrific things have gone on. So that's, alcohol is the way that they mask that pain. So do you blame anyone for that? Probably not. Is it the right thing to do? Possibly not as well, right? So I don't know what the answer is, but
right and wrong is a funny concept in my world, right? Alternative to alcohol is a downer. right? So I had this conversation just recently, and this just to tie off that piece, right? I had this conversation recently with two different people, same conversation, you know, three of us at the same time having a chat. One is hyper all the time, like me. And it's like, you need a stimulant that will help bring you down. A stimulant, but then the other person that I'm talking to needs a downer. Like they, two people, same conversation. One needs this, one needs that. You can tell. If you gave this one a stimulant, they would be white knuckled, aggressive, because that's what they're trying to avoid, because that's in them. So they need the certain things. So, you know, one of them, you know, for that person, maybe it's, a plant-based substance that, yep, you know, alternative. Whereas the other one would need something that's probably a pill form.
But I think it's also different stages in your life, right? So lost both my parents 3 years ago. And at that time, it's just sadness. You can't shake, yep, the sadness, right? And, yep, and yeah, you can try pills and stuff like that. But ultimately, I think it's just starting to, you have to learn to live with the sadness. And unfortunately, one of my best friends, his father passed away on Friday. Mm. And I'll be lying if I didn't shed a tear, because it was also my mum's birthday. And I said to him, I said, you know, wise old man that I am, but I've been through it. And I said to him, look, you've just got to get used to life being a little bit sadder at the moment than it was yesterday, right? And that's just the way it's going to be, mate. I wish I could tell you it wasn't, but you have to just learn to live with it. And I know that that's not being unkind. It's just how you have to acceptance, they say, right? You know, mm-hmm, with a lot of, you know, when you're dealing with mental health. So
I think with that one, right, like, the concept of this too shall pass, right? So you're extremely happy today, this will pass. So you're extremely sad today, this will pass as well. With things like that, so there's, I guess I'll differentiate, which is the people I was talking to, all, myself included, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. So not a, it's sort of like not a temporary thing. So very different category to the sort of, you know, the things that we do have to deal with, such as, you know, death and stuff like that. But I think the research on it is somewhere around it can take a year, if not more, for sometimes for that sadness to pass. And yeah, people will do different things in between to comfort around, yeah, that.
And it comes in waves. I mean, grief's, yeah, a good example. It does, you've got to get used to it. You'll be functioning, and then you'll be at a party, or you'll be at a middle of a business event, and then a song will come on, and it's your mum's favourite song or something, and it just triggered, takes you straight back. So, but I think you will need, my belief is that you will need different things at different times in your life, right? 100%. It might be a stimulant, it might be a downer, you know, sometimes, yep, you need think both, but
yeah.
Okay, so I'm just conscious of time. I'm really enjoying the chat so far, Michael. You talked about your childhood. What values do you think that you're looking back now that you're, what values did your parents instill in you?
Hard work and education, right? So my dad, hard work, my mother, education, done. They were them. For the first part of my life, hard work. For the second part, education. And it's that combo of those two things, yeah.
Anything that as you've progressed through adulthood that you now look back and go, I understand now?
Sometimes. Sometimes. Sometimes.
What would they be?
The hard work in education, I understand for sure. Like, but I think that the tricky part is they were both too far at either end of each other, right? So I had one that was all hard work, no education, one that was all more education based, and but still hard work, but, you know, and I think what I learned from both of them is, like with anything, Goldilocks, right? It's that not too much, not too hot, not too cold, just right. It's finding that balance of there are all these great qualities that each of them had, and if I can take all those qualities and then balance them in the middle, that is where you find your real Goldilocks zone. You know, I think at the moment I'm probably a little bit too far towards the end of – there's a lot of hard work and probably needs a little bit more balance around that part. But, yeah, I think if anything I've learned from my parents, it's that there are qualities that if you can balance those qualities, it will make you a whole balanced person.
What would you say your unfair advantage is that few others could replicate?
Oh, lived experience, you know, life without regret. There are things that I've learnt, felt, experienced that have made me who I am, that just give me an unfair advantage over other people. And I think when you combine my experience with my studies and education as well, it becomes quite a powerful sort of combination. And I guess the other part being is just the openness is, yeah, there's a degree of openness from me that is formidable. You know, there are no monsters in the closets. So it kind of is a superpower that combined with ADHD, and an openness, it puts people I work with at ease and allows them to, through my example, open up as well. They can trust, that there is no judgment from me. And I think that's probably my biggest thing is not being judgmental, because I've been pretty much where most people have been for most things.
Thank you. Okay, so let's move on to some of the professional expertise that you have. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of people listening will be tuning in for these nuggets and understanding kind of how they can improve. So we talked about how you become a speaking coach and your journey there. If you were to look back at some of the people that you've taught, who would be those people? If you're allowed to say the names, of course.
yeah, for sure. So, I mean, you can look through the TED register. I mean, for who most of them are, there are some people I can't mention. Generally around the political sphere and stuff like that.
It's that sort of level, as it's people probably the top of their game. Most people would know, but yeah. And that's where you're giving them counsel, right? You're being that advisor,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. To a degree, there would be ones I wouldn't mention from a political perspective because I don't sway either way for politics, right? Like, I coach people to get outcomes, so I don't choose between those two. But I think most noticeably, you know, or notably, the people that I coach would be people who have had just incredible experiences and combining those experiences and then being able to articulate those experiences really well is kind of the passion piece for me. So, you know, we'll take Emily Blythe, for example, right? So Emily Blythe is in New Zealand. I met her when she was, you know, around 23 years old, maybe a bit younger. And, you know, she's got this amazing idea that, you know, she's grown up as a young pilot and her family flies and her dad was a pilot, you know, or is a pilot. And it's really annoying for their family that their holidays are always disrupted by fog. And she's experienced fog firsthand. And, you know, she decides, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to stop fog from disrupting airports globally. And it's just this incredible idea. And then she's like, well, you know, but I need some money. So, you know, going to do a capital pitch raise for whatever amount of money and make this idea happen. And however many years later, it's probably 3 or 4 years later, now that is, you know, really coming to life. It's growing. But it started with getting on stage in front of 900 people, 900 potential investors, and winning, you know, the investment, but also winning best pitch of the night award. And it was just stories like that, you know, that is going to go on to change the world.
You've obviously developed a framework.
Yep.
The Epic framework, from what I saw.
So there's a framework for workshops that I do, but there's also a framework for generally working with people. There's a couple of different frameworks. So depending on the type of speaking they're doing, I might run them through a framework of like a 5-part framework. For investment pitching, definitely a 5-part framework with a narrative wraparound. So going to get technical about speaking.
Now's the time to do it, by the way. We're in the zone.
Yeah. So I love everything about speaking, right, at a technical level. But generally, an investment pitch, for example, needs a five-part, which is identify the problem, the pain, the solution, the outcome, and then the urgency of why, you know, people need to buy into or invest in this thing. But that also works for a customer success story. It works for a lot of different things. And it actually comes from a marketing background. So, you know, one of the things, again, looking to the US, who does stuff really well? Well, marketers in the US. They're really good at it. In New Zealand in particular, we're terrible. That whole tall poppy or embarrassed to push whatever it is we need to push. We're really good at just identifying the solution, right? But without pushing the problem or identifying the problem and then pushing the pain, we don't get people to, you know, really feel why this is relevant to them and why they need to make changes or why changes would help them. So that's definitely a model that I use often. And I teach in a workshop as well, and get people to record that to camera. Other models would be using a timeline narrative. So, you know, like identifying past, present, future, and then getting people to speak from the past into the present, and then looking as a visionary into the future so that a audience can follow that pattern. It can be what was, what is, what could be type of pattern. There are many that I use, but essentially I don't kind of walk into a situation and go, this is the model for that. I might try it and then I'll get them to put their messaging through it, and it either feels right or it doesn't. And if it doesn't feel right, then we change it.
What would you say the core fundamentals of good speaking are?
Respect, I would have to say, 100%, right? So respect for an audience that they have given their time, energy, and effort. They want to hear what you have to say. And if they're going to do that, then putting in the energy to make sure that the message, whatever the message is delivered in a way that is geared towards their understanding. In all the work, that's what I'm doing, you know. I'm simplifying it and making it digestible for an audience. So if approaching any situation, it's how much work has been done in advance of that will dictate the level of impact it will have on the audience. So there's that, but then of course then there are, you know, actual structural parts to content creation. And then delivery, you know. I keep coming back to delivery whenever I run a workshop. You know, it's like people have often said when we're practicing, they're like, it feels a bit weird. It feels like I'm doing a performance. And it's like, exactly, you are doing a performance. When you get up on there, you are performing. You are being a bigger, louder, larger, stronger, more impacting version of yourself, because you have to, right? And it's like, it is a performance. So if you feel like you're performing, good. If you feel like you're not being yourself, you know, not being authentic to you, then it means your messaging is wrong. And we need to change that so that when you do it, you feel like, this is good. Yeah, I get it now. It's just me, but bigger. And it's like, yeah, 100%. So, you know, respect for an audience and performance, really work on the performance base. I spoke to a friend of mine who's a speaker in New Zealand just recently, and he was saying, he got some really cool feedback from an audience, and he's been working recently on his stagecraft, right? He's got the greatest story ever. You'll probably know him when I mention that he may have been in prison for a part of his younger life. And, you know, he's got these incredible stories that he tells, but he said, I'm working on my stage presence. And he had someone come up to him and say, that was the most amazing talk I've ever seen. You know, it was powerful and stuff. He hadn't changed the talk. Talk stayed the same, but his delivery was different. The way he was just like, I want to be larger. I want to be just have more movement and more presence in how I deliver it, and more impact and meaning in my delivery, and noticeably different just by focusing on that.
Why do you think most people, and I strongly agree they do it, is most people. Why do you think most people need to improve the way they speak?
I think because every person has a outcome they want to achieve, right? And for all intentions purposes, most of those outcomes are honourable. If they're not speaking well, they won't get the outcomes they want. Not in a way that is aligned to the authenticity of themselves, right? So they want to get this, but they're doing something else which is defeating that, stopping that outcome from happening. If they really want the outcome, they need to learn how to change the structure of what they do.
What would you say? Because I kind of feel that speaking is intrinsically linked to sales, right? And yep. I was talking to Nathan, the real estate guy, the other day, and he had some really interesting points on this. But for me, speaking is the same as sales, is that you're doing sales and you're doing speaking all day, every day, in every walk of life. So if you're trying to get your kid to bed, you're doing speaking, you're doing sales, right? Yep. If you're trying to get your wife to love you more, which, you know, hopefully I don't have to do too much of, but if you're trying to get, you're speaking.
Yep.
And so surely it goes without saying that if you can improve as a speaker, you're going to improve your life and you're going to improve the outcomes. Exactly. It's not what you said, you know, improve the outcomes. So is that a fair point to say that most people, they actually benefit from, you know, the wider life rather than just the presentation that you might be preparing from?
Yeah. No, it's never just about the presentation, right?
Yeah.
Within what we do, well, within what I do, I definitely see that whatever is learnt in a coaching scenario, for a talk or within a workshop, it has to be transferable. If it's not transferable, then I haven't done a very good job. And the reason being is I will challenge people. It's not a case of good enough, you know, and I think that's just the TED part in me, is it's like good enough is not good enough. But within it, I challenge people to rethink how they are thinking about how people receive content. And that would be the most transferable thing. And we call it empathy, right? It's like actually stop, think, and empathize with people receiving this content. And that's transferable into every part of life. Ultimately, we are always trying to influence, right? That's what we're trying to do. We are trying to influence our kids to do things. As you said earlier on, you choose to use a certain phrase and it's influencing, but it's not the influence outcome you want. And if you're not self-aware, you're surrounded by people who know you as you, so they will never tell you. I'm the person that doesn't know. I'm the person that goes, actually, what's the outcome, influence you're trying to have? Yeah, doing that won't achieve it.
It's a tough one, though, because obviously you've given me a bit of help in the past, and for a session that we did a few weeks ago. And for me, it was a case of you can always improve, right? And you get a bit rusty if you haven't done it for a little while. But we did all that preparation and you helped me with the transitions and, you know, moving it from one subject to the other. And actually, you know, it was a tenfold improvement and probably before I'd had a chat with you. But I also have that problem, which I'm sure a lot of people out there listening will have, is that my mouth talks faster than my brain works.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, like, you know, thankfully I'm doing my best to try and slow it down. And if you're thinking about what you're saying, generally you're in the right spot. So how do we deal with those sorts of things?
So the fundamentals, right? How do we slow it down? So each person will inherently have their own issue. I would imagine that if I was to, you know, review you at that event.
I'm dreading how – I was about to ask how am I doing at the moment. But yeah,
you're doing great. You're doing great. So one of the things, if I was to review that, and if I asked you to review it, I would ask things like, what was your heart rate like before you began? How much were you moving in the moment? And then I would ask the question, is your movement linked to your heart rate? Right. So if my body moves more, does my heart rate increase? Yeah. And as my heart rate increases, does that make it harder for me to process my thoughts? And the answer would be, well, yeah, of course it does. I'm like, everything's up, right? So the solution to that would be to, if you're moving a lot, what would you need to do? You would need to
slow it down.
Yeah. Right?
Grip onto the podium.
The podium. Yeah. So it would be, you know, like I said, each person has their thing. So if a person's moving a lot and they can't keep up with their thoughts, then they will need to just ground themselves in the moment. Like, take a moment, when they feel it coming on and just stop, stand still, like the body and mind are connected. Which one influences the other? It's kind of like the infinity thing. They both influence each other. So the mind affects the body, the body affects the mind. Stop the body from moving, take a breath, your thoughts will come clear, and then start talking again. And you can get back to moving around, but as soon as you feel that again, it's like stop, ground, and you would end up a little bit probably structuring that. If you knew that more about yourself, you would structure that more into how you spoke and how you structured your content, right? For other people, other examples, it'll be different. Other people will be, they don't move enough. How is it that I can have more energy? And it's like, do you move at all? It's like, no. It's like, okay, we need some movement then, right? And then just finding that happy balance between all of those types of things.
Do you find there's a difference between extroverts and introverts in terms of common mistakes?
So I'm an introvert.
Really?
Yeah. So introversion and extroversion, right, which is essentially how we recuperate energy at its most basic. I am in the public eye often, right? It's, I get up in front of people, I speak, I do my stuff. It is horrendously exhausting. I do not gain energy by being around people. It takes energy. Hence, therefore, I am an introvert. When I recharge, it's a dark room, quiet and very isolated. That's me, introvert. But I've learnt how to be extroverted in how I present myself. But extroversion in itself means that when you are around people, if you get tired, it's like, I've been alone too long. I need to be around people. Oh my God, I've got to get out of here. But yeah, there's a little bit of, a little bit of interesting insights into introversion and extroversion. It's more so how you gain energy than how you actually behave. I think a lot around how people perform or how they appear on the outside would be more to do with their parental influences, their brain, wiring. I've met people who are really expressive, but because of their environment, they've had to shut it down. And they come to me going, yeah, I've got issues, like just not connecting with people. And it's like, it's not because they're introverted or extroverted, it's because they have grown up with an influence where expressing emotion in a certain way is frowned upon. So they've got this monster of expression inside them.
Yeah.
But they're...
I've always joked, like, so someone like myself, you're quite extroverted and gregarious and a little bit edgy and close to the line, but certainly not disrespectful or anything like that. But putting me in someone like let's just say an industry that isn't any of those things. Could be councils, could be government, could be something more traditional corporate. And you sometimes you've got to match the environment for your personality, right?
Yep.
So, but that said, I've also had conversations where people are saying, well, be the solution rather than the problem, right? So if you continue to think like that and everyone thinks like that, then how are we ever going to get better? How are we ever going to improve? How are we ever going to change? And how are we going to get others to be more gregarious in an industry that's sometimes you can be, you can be the opposite, and actually that's what people are craving, right? They actually need that. So what would you say the common, if we go sort of really deep now, what would you say the most common mistakes people do when speaking? When I say speaking, it could be giving a team briefing, it could be, which is probably what most listeners will have to do, it could be organizing a meeting, but there's probably some absolute common mistakes that you see time and time and time and time again. So what would they be?
There's one. One, I'll keep it easy for people. They don't prepare. That's it. And I mean, it's a shame because in a lot of environments, people are, like, can you do this presentation? Or not can you? You've got to do this presentation tomorrow at da-da-da. And it's like, oh, okay. And that's awful, right? They don't have time to prepare. They're not given time to prepare. I think people underestimate people who pass on tasks to someone else don't respect the fact of like, well, actually, to do that well, you need to prepare. And if you are given the time and you don't prepare, then that is a major issue. But most all of what I see is a lack of preparation.
Yeah.
You know.
That's in all walks of life though, right?
All walks of life. Yeah. It doesn't matter where you are with it. But then you've got the other one, which is over-preparation. And it's a weird thing to say. Like, how can you over-prepare? It's like, well, you're so worried about something that you spend months and months and months in advance and you over-prepare this thing and you over-bake it. But the problem being is you've not filtered it through anyone. So it hasn't been refined, right? And there's all this nervousness around it and the nervousness has been built up. So again, it's the Goldilocks zone between knowing, preparing enough and then knowing when to let go and know that you know what you need to know. And it's a fine line between those two things. If you get it wrong on either end, you've underprepared and just gone, my charisma will get me through this, you know, my personality, my whatever, it'll get me through. Or you've overprepared and all you've done is built yourself up so much around the anxiety around it that you technically make it like ruin it for yourself and for the audience.
What would you say the common myths are around good speakers?
That good speakers are, you know, one, the introversion, extroversion thing, that there is a better style of speaker. As in one is more innate, or that charisma is innate, which it's not. We now know that it's a very learnable skill. So University of Lausanne, study on charismatic leadership tactics. There's research around that that you can probably share through the,
through the group. Yep.
Without diving into it too far. But essentially we see someone, and I'm guilty of this, right? I did this when I was young. I remember seeing someone get on stage and they just spoke really well. And I looked at them and I just went, oh man, I'd love to, but I can't. Like, that's just not, I don't have that in me. They have a skill that I will never have. And I watched them for years doing this thing. And I was like, I reckon I could do that better, actually, you know. But it was just seeing people do things going, yeah, no. That's something that you're born with. And it's like, you're not. We're not born with this natural innate skill to be able to speak or present or perform really well. It's a skill that is learnt through dedication, determination, discipline, and direction.
Yep. And I think even just doing this podcast for the last 4 or 5 weeks, it's funny how you start admiring other people's craft.
Yeah.
And when you listen, something you said to me actually, you know, a few weeks ago, when you said, watch, learn, you know, record yourself, listen. Mm-hmm. And so obviously by doing the podcast, I'm actually able to do that. And I do listen. I listen to it and you go, oh, yeah, I could improve that bit. And so I've stopped saying my, you knows and the years as much, pausing, breathing, all those kind of key, good stuff you teach. Okay. So just finally, personal brand. Why is that so important to you?
For a lot of years, you know, you start off business and you build this amazing website. You build the website, you get the right colors, you get the right words, you get the right stuff, and you put it out there and you're like, yeah, people are going to know now. They're going to come, you know, build it and they'll come. And it's like, nope, doesn't happen. You know, a lot of fixation in the background is on being really good. And I see this a lot. I see people who are exceptionally good at what they do, but they haven't established a personal brand that enables people to know who they are and what they do. And I suffered that at the start for a long time, right? So, you know, creating our own business, and it was like exactly what I said, building everything in the background, but waiting for something to come along. And it was like, it doesn't happen. So a personal brand has to be built. And the personal brand is just a, I mean, it's many faceted. One, it's a declaration of who you are, what you stand for, what you do and why you do it. For me, personal brand has turned into a way of me not hiding a part of myself, you know, so authentic personal brand. You know, my brand is going through a massive change right now. As you know, you know, both my hands are now tattooed. So up until recently, I could put on a full suit and you would know nothing about my history. And I wanted to take that away. I didn't want to be able to hide parts of myself because I believe that my personal brand is about showing all parts of myself. If I expect other people to be vulnerable around me and share their deeper, darker personal stories or their stories of hope ultimately, then who am I to be hiding that myself? And personal brand for me drives my tribe, right? So like my vibe attracts my tribe. I don't want to end up in a room full of people that I'm pretending to be someone else to be in that room with. I'd be in the wrong room. So personal brand has a lot of facets, but it's also a precarious type of thing. It needs to be nurtured, built, refined and rethought and reinvented, you know, rejuvenated every now and then, because you look on my website and there's a photo of me from only a few years ago, and that is definitely not who I am today. You know, I keep evolving and growing, and so does my brand, personal brand. I think personal brand, you know, one of the cool things that we're starting to get into now with the workshops that I'm running is we're diving more into personal brand. Originally, it was around pitching and presenting and public speaking, but now we're actually starting to touch on some cool stuff. My kind of, I love marketing, right? But we're getting into, how are you using video? Like I can teach these skills so you can walk into a room of strangers and do a 60-second pitch, like introduction thing. But it's like, you know, that's a little bit old hat. We're not doing that so much anymore. We just want a genuine connection with people. So we're looking more at, you know, video content creation for marketing, for personal brand. And it's bringing people who have been in the background of the business and bringing them to the forefront, sharing stories and highlighting more people in the organization.
And you mentioned about evolving, but that's so true. Because if you think even in the last sort of 8 or 9 years, the content we probably would have created 9 years ago, which you used to say, oh, you no more than 2 minutes. Now that's probably 20 seconds, right?
Yep.
The reality is we've got no attention spans because things like TikTok and YouTube.
Oh, and cough syrup.
And cough syrup. Cough syrup as well. That's all the cough. Absolutely, it's the cough syrup. So, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Involved. I mean, I'd probably be in that category as well. You know, you think about 9, 10 years ago, I was wearing the grey suit and the boring. And actually, what I do like about the moment though is, and certainly the era that we're in, is that you actually can be yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I want to be a podcaster and an IT consultant and a football coach, I can be all three. I don't have to pick one and choose one, right?
Some people can be themselves. And I think that's, you know, we're still pushing for that. I mean, my goal is to lead that by surrounding myself with people who can be themselves, you know, your tribe. But there are people out there that cannot be themselves, that are scared to death of being themselves. So, it's half and half. I mean, when you're in the world of being able to be yourself, you know, and you know, as far as changing and adapting and moving and shifting, you've just been through your own thing where you've changed and now you're taking on this podcast thing and so you're evolving as well. Like say you were at the point where you're wearing suits, but something progressively changed, you know, your thoughts around what is professionalism. I think COVID had a huge impact on that for us. You know, people in their pajamas, like, actually I'm as effective at my job irrespective of what I look like, you know. So these things are all starting to play a part in how that personal brand is.
I also think you've got to be a chameleon there as well. I mean, we talk about personal brand, but I think there's times you put the suit on, there's times you don't, there's times you turn up in a black t-shirt, there's times you turn up in your jandals and your shorts, right? And I think it's just knowing your audience and knowing how you would feel in that audience as well, because, you know, you might not want to be in your jandals when everyone's wearing a nice shirt and tie.
Agreed. I will give a caveat to that though, which is, and this is from an experience I just had recently, right? So I think of my suit as a suit of armor. I used to wear it to protect me, to fit into the room that I was going into. And that meant that I had to change who I was, right? I was covering up and hiding something that was there. I just got asked to MC an event recently, and I asked a lot of questions around the event. Who's going to be there? What are the people like? And the room, very high profile room full of people, and I ended up with no shoes on stage, having a hell of a good time. But if that room had been full of suits, and it had been me having to cover up myself, I would have turned down that job. Yeah. And the reason being is, ultimately, you know, if I did that gig and it was to attract clients, if I have to pretend not to be me to work with those people, I would rather not work with them. Because it would make it really difficult, you know. At some point they're going to find out who I really am.
You're wearing a mask.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, and it is hard and it is scary. You know, I follow people that challenge me on that all the time. You know, in New Zealand, we've got Shelley Davis, huge, yeah, shout out to Shelley, right? Shelley's been one of my, she's been one of my inspirations since I first got onto social platforms like LinkedIn, right? Just hardcore, this is who I am. And respectfully, this is who I am. And I have boundaries, and there are people I do and don't want to work with. And then you've got Leah, who's in the UK, tattoos up her neck, just totally different. And she's just like, this is who I am. This is how I do stuff. And I look at those people, and there are many, many others, and I just go, they're successful. Like, they're really successful, but they're getting bought into rooms to be them. They're not getting bought into rooms to be someone who they're not. And I think that is really powerful, you know, when you can just be you. You know, that whole thing about, you know, what are the problems speakers have? Not being themselves, you know, not being in environments where they can be themselves. And I don't mean being yourself means that you have a vernacular that has to have, you know, like, be rough or anything like that. I mean, we can all refine how we speak. I mean, I love to swear. I do. But I also grew up teaching children, you know, like when I was in the outdoors. I can turn that switch off. It's a choice. Being myself doesn't mean I'm just allowed to express all of me. There are parts of it that don't require expression. They are choosing. But I'm in a position where I can tailor and make content and be the best parts of myself without having to cover any of that. And I think that's really important for everyone. And I say that because, you know, this whole ADHD thing, we're getting so used to it, but I've still got men my age private messaging me going, Michael, I think I've got ADHD. I'm like, why are you whispering in a message? I'm worried if anyone finds out, I won't get any work. I'm like, what? What? I mean, here's me, you know, talking about it publicly. Here's me going, oh, I've got ADHD. But here's another, you know, another person my age going, I'm scared. And it's like, this is the thing. You know, we live in a world where there are still people out there struggling to be themselves. And I want people to be themselves. Yeah.
Okay. Last question of the day. I've asked this for most of the people that have been on the podcast. If I could go back and ask 21-year-old Michael, so you've got to go back and give 21-year-old Michael a bit of advice, what would that be?
Oh, now I'll take a drink. I was just about to cry. The advice would be, don't worry, everything's going to be okay.
Spoken like Bob Marley.
Mm. Yeah. That's the thing, right? Like, any advice I would have given to that 20-year-old myself wouldn't have been followed. You know, that 21-year-old had a lot of stuff going on, but all that 21-year-old and the 40-something-year-old that I am now, all that that one wants to know is that, actually, everything's going to be okay. It doesn't matter, you know, from my life experience, through all the stuff I've been through, everything has ultimately actually turned out okay. At a fundamental, when someone says maybe you should go talk to someone, you know, like my wife, need to go and talk to the doctor. It's like, listen to that a little bit more often, you know. And the thing that you fear most in life is probably the thing that you need most. You know, I ran away from structure. I ran as far from it as I could when the thing I needed most in my life back then was structure. Yeah.
Michael, really appreciate your time today. Appreciate your honesty, appreciate your humility, and thank you. That's all I can say. So thank you so much for taking time on the podcast, and I will look forward to seeing your continued progress and your continued evolution on LinkedIn. So on that final note, if anyone wants to follow you or to get hold of you or to contact you, best way to do that?
Through Natalie. Through my EA. Before we go there, thanks, man. Like, thank you for taking the time, making the time. It's, you know, very enjoyable to chat. And, yeah, you've had some really good questions which have – made some soul searching happen, which is great. I like that. It's nice to go deep with people. Contacting me is through LinkedIn is the best one. Follow me on there. Well, don't follow me, connect with me, you know. It'd be great if you could. And if you need to reach out to me, just send me a message through LinkedIn, and I've got an auto out of office reply for my ADHD, and it will send a bounce back message straight away that gives you contact details for Natalie, my EA. But definitely reach out to me if you need to on any of the subjects we've spoken about. I am happy to talk about that.
Michael, thank you.
Thanks, bud.
So that's episode 6 done. I'm sure you'll agree Michael had a fascinating story to tell, and it was truly amazing to hear how people can be truly productive despite the hardship and adversity that life throws up. If you haven't done so already, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, as it helps me to focus on future guests and I get to hear about the topics that you like listening to. If you do want to get in touch, please do so by contacting me on LinkedIn, or you can email me at lee@leestevens.co. That's lee@leestevens.co. Have a good week.